Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can tweet us, we're at News Talk Science. Or more commonly, we're found now on Blue Sky at News Talk Science as well. First off in the program, we're going to look back at some of the breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the University of Galway. You're both very welcome. Jess, let's start off with yours. Our first story has to do with the Parker Solar Probe.
That's right. And if you can just imagine for a second, spending Christmas Eve instead of with your family in the vacuum of space in 980 degrees Celsius temperatures at a speed that would take you from Tokyo to New York in just a minute, getting closer to the sun than any human-made object has ever gotten. So this is how NASA's Parker Solar Probe spent this Christmas Eve. This is an amazing satellite that was launched back in 2018. And the purpose of this satellite, as you can guess, is to get as close to the sun as possible. So it's been working on it since 2018. It's been getting closer and faster to the sun using gravity assists from Venus flybys. It's actually passed the sun 21 times already. But this pass, right before Christmas, was only 6.1 million kilometers from the surface. Now, wait, that sounds pretty far. It sounds pretty far still. I know.
I was going to say, like, you know, 250,000 meters. That's very, very far away.
Well, the thing is, if you think of it as the Earth and Sun just being separated by like 1 meter, then the Parker Solar Probe would only be 4 centimeters from the Sun. So it really is very close to the surface of the Sun. Very, very hot, very extreme conditions, obviously. And the reason why it's there is to study the Sun's corona. Now, this is the part of the Sun's atmosphere that you can see as these kind of like fiery filaments that are around the sun during an eclipse. You know, we all saw a lot of pictures of those last year. It's very hot. It's not very bright. We probably all have an X like that, you know, but the particles that are in the corona, they're interesting, unlike those X's, because they're being accelerated away from the sun very quickly. No one really understands why that's happening. And the temperature of the corona itself is much higher than the actual surface of the sun. No one really understands that either. And this corona, it's the source of the solar wind, which is both the, you know, beautiful charged particles that cause the aurora, which we love to look up at, but they also cause space weather that can knock out satellites and power grids. It's actually something that's really relevant to us here on Earth. And so that's what the Parker Solar Probe is there to look at. Now, we know so far that this latest flyby worked. The probe sent back a signal saying it's safe, all is good, happy new year. And basically, it's going to start sending new data when it comes back into better alignment with the Earth. So really exciting for astrophysicists and solar enthusiasts alike this spring. We're going to start getting a lot of really cool data back from the Parker Solar Probe, probably a lot of really new science too.
One of our best solar scientists, Professor Peter Gallagher of the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies, is particularly interested in this. I spent some time hanging out of a military plane 3 hours off the side of Ireland, pointing cameras into the heart of an eclipse to try and get information on exactly that question. Why do we see hotter temperatures not in the core, but actually at the edge? So be really interesting to see what happens with that. Ruth, our second story has to do with loneliness. And this is quite unusual because we often hear about, you know, the effects of certain things causing loneliness, but it's never really causal. We never really see underlying mechanisms.
I mean, I think science has shown us and research has shown us a lot of associations between loneliness and poor health outcomes. People might have heard, you know, it's been quoted that being lonely can be as damaging to your health as being a cigarette smoker. And I suppose we do know that people who are socially isolated have a higher chance of having heart disease and stroke compared to people who are very socially connected. But I suppose this study, which was published in Nature Human Behavior from researchers in Shanghai and Cambridge, is starting to get under the hood of what might be going on at a molecular mechanism linked to loneliness and social isolation that might make that happen. And they use data from over 42,000 participants who are in this UK biobank study. So this is people who volunteered to give biological samples to the biobank, but they're also providing lots of different information about their lives and their health. So it's an incredible resource for researchers. And what they found was, when they looked at people who reported very high levels of loneliness, and they adjusted for things like ethnicity and lifestyle issues and income and alcohol consumption, they identified 175 proteins associated with social isolation and 26 proteins associated with loneliness. And they also found that there was, when they looked at those proteins, one single protein doesn't tend to cause a complex disease, but you might find an elevated level of clusters of proteins that are all working together in a metabolic pathway. And then they looked at these proteins and they did genome-wide association studies on other people. So not looking at the same data where they found the proteins, but looking at other biobanks. And they were able to find five proteins that seemed to be causally associated with loneliness and social isolation. And one of those proteins is called adrenomedullin, or ADM. And this is a protein that helps to regulate your blood pressure. It's involved in the immune response. And there was other proteins also involved in inflammation. So this is sort of looking at this idea of loneliness as a stressor on the body. And we know that while initially, stress might boost your immune system to get you into that fight or flight response, that chronic stress can actually damage your immune system and may actually be having an impact on the parts of the brain that are involved in kind of processing social connections and the type of things that we need to do to be socially connected.
Obviously, you know, when we think about, you know, proteins, this is, you know, product of our genetic workings. It's not something that we can necessarily deal with nutrition necessarily. I mean, obviously there are mechanisms to try and improve mental health, but this isn't something where there's an easy target medically yet.
No, although there may well be a genetic predisposition to finding it harder to make those kind of social connections. Proteins in our body, yes, they're related to our genes, but the environment also plays a big impact. I mean, just for example, you know, you can change what's going on in your metabolism based on what you eat. But I think what this is doing, it's moving away from just those purely correlative studies to actually looking at causality and the what underpins it. But it's kind of coming back to the thing that we already knew, which is that loneliness is really bad for you. So we already knew it, but now we're just understanding it a bit better. So it makes a real difference to your health if you can have those social connections. So, you know, it's another incentive to reach out to someone maybe if you think they might be lonely.
Thanks very much. And particularly, you know, in the weather we're having, doubly so. Jess, our third story has to do with the Romans.
That's right. And if there's one thing that we know about the ancient Romans is that they loved lead. They sweetened their wine with lead acetate. They drank water that was delivered through lead pipes. They used lead in their cosmetics and paint. They just couldn't get enough of it. And it wasn't great for them, because we know now, right, that lead poisoning creates a lot of heart and cognitive problems. It's especially bad in children. It's cumulative. So, you know, if you're in environments like ancient Rome and you're around lead all the time, not great. And there have been a lot of studies in the past looking at basically lead poisoning from human remains from ancient Rome and showing that, yeah, it was a big problem. But there's a new study, which is actually really interesting, also about lead and the ancient Romans, but more focused on what they were breathing in, which is actually one of the earliest examples of industrial pollution. So the ancient Romans smelted a bunch of silver, especially during this period that's called the Pax Romana, from about 15 BC to 180 AD. Like they were very prosperous, not at war for once, making lots of silver coins, having a great time. And the way that the ancient Romans and lots of other civilizations got silver is that they would take this lead-rich mineral called galena and they would smelt it. And you might get an ounce of silver and have to process like 10,000 ounces of lead. So, you know, not a great process, but I guess if you're economically doing well, you can afford it. And what I had never thought about before is that this actually puts a huge amount of lead into the atmosphere. It puts so much lead into the atmosphere that you can actually measure it using ice cores from the Arctic. So this new research is coming from the Desert Research Institute in Nevada in the US. They basically looked at ice cores from Greenland and Russia from the Arctic, and found that you could see where the Pax Romana was in the kind of ice core record from these really high amounts of lead. So basically, like, lead was in the atmosphere and coming from ancient Rome, but like moving up to the Arctic, you know, throughout the world, and then like falling in snow onto the top of Greenland, getting condensed into these ice cores. So like really a huge amount of lead, which obviously, like, that's very widespread pollution coming from ancient Rome, but also, you know, not so great for the ancient Romans, especially anyone living near these mining and smelting areas who are probably breathing in quite a lot of lead. So the other thing that these researchers did beyond looking at these ice cores was try to calculate, okay, if we know the impact that lead poisoning has on IQ from measurements in the 20th century around, you know, lead poisoning in our modern day, do we think that the ancient Romans would have had IQ impacts from all of this lead that they were breathing? And the answer is yes, definitely.
No way.
It wasn't great. Now, the calculated impact that these researchers from the Desert Research Institute put out were only about like 2 to 3 IQ points. Also, IQ, kind of a problematic measure. But if you think about the fact that they're only looking at this inhaled lead and not even taking all that like wine, water, cosmetics, lead exposure into account, it really kind of gives you a picture of ancient Rome as a place where a lot of civilization stuff was happening, but also a lot of lead, like really just so much, much lead.
Which doesn't sound healthy. And actually, you know, speaking of lead's impact on IQ, when I was traveling around Thailand, we used to drink this drink called Sang Tip. And legend had it, this particular whiskey was brewed in lead pipes. And that was the reason why you went absolutely bananas on it. Now, I don't know if that's necessary. It feels like
might have been the alcohol content on that drink.
May have been something to that. But yeah, I mean, I must go and check that out.
But I think, isn't it interesting? Because we can kind of look back in dismay and think, you know, why would the Romans put all this lead into their air and onto their bodies? And of course, the answer is because they didn't know what it was doing. But if we look at what we're doing today in modern society with pollution, you know, we do know what we're doing, but we're doing it anyway. And we know that we're putting microplastics into our food and our environment that are probably getting into our brains. So future scientists,
our IQ.
Yeah, they'll look back at us and go, what were they thinking?
If there are any future scientists, of course. Our final story, Ruth, has to do with sloths and giant sloths.
And
in fact, the humans lived with them at the same time.
And your favorite topic, Jonathan, really, which is, you know, when did humans have, you know, get to different parts of the globe? When did modern humans emerge? And the kind of constantly changing needle of dates that we have to contend with.
We don't know is the answer,
We just don't know. And it's research that was reported on this week, and it was done by the University of São Paulo and the Smithsonian Institute. And I guess that the sort of traditional story of humans getting to the Americas has been that humans crossed the land bridge, you know, during the Ice Age, the Bering Land Bridge, and they got to the US maybe 15 to 20,000 years ago. Those were the original kind of Native Americans. One of the big finds of those people was near a town called Clovis in New Mexico. So they're often called the Clovis people. And this was a really neat story because around the same time, there was widespread extinction of large mammals in both North and South America. Both continents lost about 70 to 80% of their large mammals. So the story is the humans came, and they wiped out these large mammals. But this research sort of tells a different story. And this is really about a find of human remains going back nearly 30,000 years from Santa Helena in Brazil. So it's evidence of people being there 27,000 years ago. But one of the things they also found were sloth bones. So these are, as you said, giant sloths, not the furry creatures that we know nowadays. These things could have been, you know, up to 4 tons. They had huge claws and they almost had scales like an armadillo. And those scales or osteoderms would have been taken by humans and carved to use as jewelry and pendants. And what the researchers can see is that humans back 30,000 years ago were carving what looked like fresh bone. So they weren't picking up fossil bones from these sloths. They were actually fresh bones. So this kind of rewrites the story for us again, because it means not only that humans were in the Americas way before the Clovis people, many, many thousands of years before, but also that they were living alongside a lot of those large mammals that didn't go extinct for many, many years afterwards. So things like giant sloths, things like mastodons, which is in the same family as the mammoth, things like saber-toothed tigers. And it just means that our ancestors were probably hunting and possibly even being hunted by these huge creatures for many, many years.
Yes, I mean, the Flintstones is often kind of used as a bit of a joke of, you know, muddling up human and animal history, but not as miles off.
Maybe not.
And as this story continues to change and years get thrown around like cornflakes at a kid's breakfast, Who knows? Maybe we'll find out that humans actually coexisted with dinosaurs. Only research.
We won't be definitive. We won't be definitive today. Yeah,
well, certainly we'll try and be more cautious than some of the papers that we've read over the past 15 years. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and from University of Galway, Dr. Jessamyn Fairfield, thank you so much. Now, if you're like me and struggle to tell an oak from an alder, you might be surprised to find out how much trees can tell us about the world, our history, and their place in it. I have to say, it's rare I come across a book that has so many nuggets of information I haven't come across, having done this program for 15 years, but Tristan Gooley's How to Read a Tree is one of those. He joins me now. Tristan, welcome to the program. Maybe you might give us a little bit of a background to you and how you have got this relationship with nature that I really feel like I wish I had, but I really don't.
Thanks, Jonathan. My background was I was a restless kid, and I worked out that shaping journeys, and they started really, really small, was fun. I didn't really like being told where to go, and small journeys became big ones, and I fell in love with the art of navigation, and I ended up putting together some quite big and unusual expeditions in by my 20s. But I found actually the experience wasn't keeping up with the physical and you know, just the challenge of doing a big expedition. So I turned everything on its head in my 20s, which is a little while back now, and started doing very small journeys, just finding my way using nature. And there's so much talk these days about, you know, we should immerse ourselves in nature, we should reconnect and this sort of stuff. And they're lovely ideas, but I don't think they have much impact, because you're either plugged in or you're not. And so what I found was that if you just walk in a park or across a woods and you say, okay, I'm going to try and find my way across this woods just using nature's clues and signs, then you can use the sun, moon, stars, plants, animals, wind, weather, all sorts of things. But for 25 years now, trees have always been fairly close to one of my, you know, favorite and most practical and helpful signs. So trees have been helping me to navigate since my 20s, and I'm 51 now.
In the book, you reveal so much about trees that I hadn't really ever considered. Take us through some of these, if you don't mind. When we look at a tree in a park or in a wild setting, what are some of the things that we can learn about navigation and where we are in the world from a tree?
Okay, so what I'd encourage everybody to do is pick two trees that look similar, and then notice how they're not identical. Of the billions of trees on planet Earth, there are no two trees that are identical, and every small difference is trying to tell us something. It has been shaped by that tree's life. And we can think of there being two broad influences here. We've got the genetic influence. So if we see a tree, and so much of this stuff is obvious in hindsight, but we don't actually think along these lines. Our ancestors did. But if we see a tree, it's whispering one powerful, simple message, which is, I survived. You know, 100 other species might have tried to make a go of this spot, but I made it. So if you understand anything about me, I will tell you something about where you are. So if we take a nice sort of straightforward genetic example, all trees have to specialize. Willows and alders specialize in coping with very wet ground. So if we see a line of willows, we don't actually have to even know they're called willows. We just see a line of trees next to a river. We pair that observation and that pattern with water, and this is exactly what our ancestors did and what indigenous people do to this day, then our brain is brilliant at taking the next step, and it will do the pairing, and it will tell us the next time we see that pattern, it'll say, oh, by the way, you're about to come across a river. So that's the genetic part. Then we've got the environmental. So everybody's familiar, I think, with the nature-nurture, you know, influences. We're now talking about nurture. So a tree that is in an exposed area, maybe in the middle of a wide open park or on top of a hill or something like that, will get battered by the winds, and the top will bend over from the southwest towards the northeast in across northwest Europe, because that's the prevailing trend. And really what I've done over decades is just collect every single one of those examples that works and use them to help me find my way, and then put them down in the book.
You have these illustrations in the book that show us how we can tell north from south using really simple methods I hadn't considered at all. which way winds are generally prevailing. Can you take us through some of those?
Yeah, sure. Natural navigation relies very heavily on the idea of asymmetry. There is nothing in the natural world that is symmetrical. Even the sun isn't symmetrical. So what we find is, if we stick with the sun for a moment, if you ask somebody in the middle of the day, where is the sun in the middle of the day? They'll go, oh, it's sort of overhead, but it's never overhead of anyone north of the tropics. So the whole of Europe, for example, the sun is due south in the middle of the day. So we can use that as a compass. Shadows point north at lunchtime, broadly speaking. But what we find is the trees are, you know, that sunlight is breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the trees. So it would be a bit odd if they're symmetrical, and we find they're not. There is more tree, there are more and bigger branches on the south side, because that's where most of the light and energy is coming from. And then what we find is, if we just zoom into every single part of the tree, we find these asymmetries. So the branches are different angles on the north and south side. They're closer to horizontal on the south side of a tree, because there's lots of bright, low light coming in on the south side. On the north side of a tree, not so much light, so we have fewer branches, but the light that does reach the north side is coming from directly above. So we find the branches reach up towards the sky. They're closer to vertical on the north side. And even the angles of leaves, it's all based in science. It's all common sense with hindsight, but it's slightly invisible because our modern lifestyle tells us that, you know, smartphones have the answer and trees don't. But the trees have got the answers.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never really thought of how different sides of a tree look different. Even the leaves themselves tells a huge amount about what a tree has been through, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The way, you know, if we go for a short walk past a few trees, we will pass literally thousands of clues. Some of them are bold and easy to read. Some of them are a bit subtler. But if we take leaves, for example, leaves point down towards the ground on the south side of a tree, and they point out. They're closer to flat on the north side for the reasons we've discussed, the light. But their shapes and colors are giving us messages. So if you see a leaf with a very pointed tip, that is not what one of the ideas I'm always trying to get across is nature. It's tough out there. Nature doesn't do random stuff for the hell of it. What it does do is it adapts and evolves to the situation it finds itself in. So a tip on a leaf has evolved not randomly, but to channel rainwater off. So if you see lots of pointed tips, you're in quite a wet area. So if you go to jungles, for example, all the leaves have these dramatic pointed tips. But we see it in the trees, you know, we pass every day. And the size of a leaf is telling you how tough it is out there. So conifers, for example, are a sign you're in a tough part of the world. It's either, you know, windy, cold, dry. You know, we find conifers halfway up a mountain. We find broadleaf trees down in the valley. And that's because the smaller the leaf, the better it is. I mean, one of the reasons, there are others, but basically the smaller the leaf you see, the tougher the environment. So it's part of a map. It's a broad brush map.
Like, as you're saying all of these things, I'm thinking back to the many forest walks I've had with the dog and wondering, how is all of this not common knowledge? It certainly doesn't seem like something I was taught in school. Am I just hugely ignorant, or do a lot of people not know these things?
I know it's I think it's a purely cultural thing. Our brain hasn't really changed genetically in the last 10,000 years. All that's happened is culture has changed dramatically over the last few thousand years, and very, very rapidly over the last 100 years. You know, there's been as much change in the last 20 years as there probably was, you know, between 5,000 and 10,000 years ago. So what's happened is the way I look at it is, as animals, we're pretty underwhelming and unimpressive in lots of areas. We're not very fast. Our senses aren't that good. We're not that strong, but we do, some would argue, too well. And the reason is because of what's going on between our ears. And one of the things we do better than the animal kingdom is pattern recognition and deduction. So a bird or a deer will pick up on an alarm call or notice perhaps strengthening in the wind. But what a human being can do is look at a landscape and go, okay, I can tell from that phase of the moon, that shape of the tree there, the breeze I'm feeling on my right cheek, the scent I'm picking up, that I'm not going to go fishing tonight. There's no point, because I know that that pattern is telling me the fish won't be there. I'm going to go tomorrow. So that historically is how we gained an edge. We could tell what was going on by reading these patterns and coming up with a richer, better picture. All that's happened is we've decided that, you know, screens, smartphones, and, you know, lots of good things as well. You know, we can enjoy art and you know, films and novels and all sorts of things using the power of the brain. I'm not saying it's all bad, but what all that's happened is we've said to our brain, you know, actually the ping on the phone is a more important pattern recognition than understanding that the color of a leaf can give me a clue how to get home.
Yeah, and I suppose nowadays it probably is. When it comes to the roots of a tree, what can we learn from them?
Yeah, the roots have two main jobs. As we know, they're supplying the tree with water and nutrients and minerals. But their other main job is structural. And if you look close to the trunk of a mature tree, the roots closest to the trunk aren't actually, their main job is actually structural. They are stopping the tree from falling over. And as we've discussed, the winds aren't random. We find we get these patterns, we get more winds from the southwest. So some roots, known as guy roots, grow bigger, stronger, and longer on the side the winds come from. And we can see this from quite a distance. I mean, it's sometimes really, I mean, this morning I was doing a little natural navigation exercise across some snow, and just by looking at the low level, just above the snow, I could see this effect. I call it the elephant's foot effect. If you imagine an elephant's foot with the toes spreading out, the toes point into the direction the winds come from. So the toes point southwest across northwest Europe. And yeah, we don't have to kind of get a spade and start digging to look at the roots. The patterns are really evident above the surface.
When we talk about animals or trees, there's always a danger of anthropomorphization. But you talk about how social a tree is and how we might determine that. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the core ideas behind the book, but behind my whole philosophy and how I'm approaching this thing, is randomness doesn't work as a strategy. So what does work is specialization. So if a tree, an animal, or any other species, you know, forgive the anthropomorphization here, there's a point to it, but if he wakes up in the morning and goes, I'm just going to do a bit of everything, what happens is a specialist species will come along that's better suited to that patch of planet Earth and outcompete it. So what we find is every single tree is specializing in some way. So bark is an example. You know, we've all seen smooth bark and rough bark. And we kind of stop and think, well, if that's not random, what's it telling us? Well, some trees, birches, think of silver birches, you know, you can almost cut your hand by running your hand across a silver birch bark. It's really rough in places. Birches specialize by sending out millions of airborne seeds and getting to places first. But the price of getting somewhere first is you're going to be absolutely hammered by the elements, you know, sun, wind, rain, but also animals. So you've got to defend against that. So rough bark is a sign of a tree that's at the edge of woods or sometimes on its own. Smooth bark, something like a beech tree, different specialization, different strategy. Okay, we're going to get strength in numbers. As I speak to you, I'm looking through a window at a few dozen beech trees, really smooth bark. But it's no coincidence that I'm seeing dozens of them, because they haven't evolved. Their strategy, their specialization is not to pop up randomly somewhere. They have evolved to expect to have neighbors giving them some shelter from the elements.
This is amazing. I'm really enjoying this. The type of tree that we find also can tell us a little bit about the history of a place, because you might be in a wood and find trees that aren't normally found there, and it can tell us a little bit about a human activity many years ago.
Yeah, we can think again. If we think of strategy, there are two broad strategies that work really well. In the book, I call them tortoise and hare. But in tree terms, some trees are colonizing trees, and they typically are, their aim is to get huge numbers of small seeds out there to grow very fast, grab a bit of land. And these trees, birches are one of the best examples. They don't live long. A birch doesn't live a lot longer than a human being. So other trees are more the tortoises. They have big seeds. Think of things like acorns and conkers and things like that. These trees are the climax trees. So they go much, much slower. They tend to be more shade tolerant. So if you're a colonizing tree, if you're a hare, you get out there, you get loads of light, you make loads of stuff happen, and it's all over, you know, it's a smash, grab, bang type strategy. But the slower trees, you know, they can tolerate a little bit more shade, But they take their time. But what happens is they eventually cast shade over the colonizing trees. So what this means in map terms is if you're let's say for fun, let's say you're lost in a woods, you are most likely surrounded by these slow tortoise trees, things like oaks and chestnuts and beeches and things like that. Mm. They've got big seeds. If you're trying to find your way out using tree clues, if you're heading towards the edge of the woods, you should expect the trees to get smaller because colonizing trees don't live as long. So birches are a really good sign. If you're lost in the woods and you start seeing some birch trees, you know, the silver rough bark, then you're meeting the colonizing trees. It's a good sign that you're about to emerge from the woods.
There's a story in the book where, I mean, this sort of seems like magic to me, but that you find things by following trees. So, for example, the story you tell, the Spanish walnut grove, or in Devon, finding a churchyard because of the signs that trees are telling you. How do you go about doing that?
I'm always looking for patterns and asymmetry and anomalies. So the part of the challenge for all of us every single day is our brain is hit with so much information that one of the brain's most important jobs is to bin almost everything. By some accounts, we get hit with 11 million bits of information per second. So the brain would just kind of melt. So what it does is it says, all right, well, 10 million of that we're just not going to bother thinking about. So in my world, what I'm really doing is instead of letting my brain go off, and this is where, you know, people are enjoying and seeing the benefits of things like mindfulness and meditation. And this is similar but different. It's just saying, instead of just seeing the stuff as green and brown noise, I'm going to look at some bark and try and work out which way is north and south. And then what happens is all of these things that were hiding in plain sight just start to become almost like technicolor. They leap out. So if I'm walking across a landscape, instead of letting my brain go, oh, there are some trees there, I'm just pausing and saying, wait a minute, don't bin that with the 10 million other bits of stuff. Just pause a minute. Why are the trees there and nowhere else? Oh, somebody's planted some tamarisks. That's a very wind tolerant tree. So there's something interesting behind that. Oh, what is it? Oh, I found a sort of secret chapel there. But that's all it is. It's just saying, don't bin everything. Have a pause and ask yourself a question, and it suddenly leaps out into sort of technicolor.
I'm gonna make it my mission to try and be a bit more mindful about the trees that are around me next time I go for a walk. And I highly recommend this book because it, if you walk at all, and if you look around at the world around you, there is so much to learn from this book that should be sort of inherent knowledge, I feel, but we've lost through the years for the reasons that Tristan's gone through. It's called How to Read a Tree. Tristan Gooley, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Jonathan. Loved our chat. Cheers.
All right, that is it from us on Future Proof. Thanks to producer Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.